There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to a brand new Arseblog Arsecast right here on arseblog.com. How are you? Hope you're well. Thank you very much indeed, as always, for being here. I know we had an extra Arsecast on Wednesday, which might in another week have taken the place of the regular Friday Arsecast. But you know what? I was in the mood for a bit of a chat. So that's what I did. Because I was thinking, you know, this week, having watched Chelsea and how bad they are. I mean, they really are bad, all laughing aside. Well, no, actually, you know, keep the laughing on the main plate, on the dinner plate. You don't want a side of laughter. You want a main of laughter when it comes to Chelsea. But I was trying to understand how an organization that, you know, is worth so much money, has these people in charge of it, could make the decisions that they have made this season, which have obviously influenced and contributed the poor campaign that they have. You know, how do you, even if you're desperate, bring in Frank Lampard, you know, given his track record at Everton?
The legend that is Frank Lampard, the Chelsea legend.
Everton, a big, big club that could be relegated from the Premier League this season. Leeds sacked their manager, brought in another manager to help them avoid relegation, have sacked him, and now they brought in Sam Allardyce. Sam Allardyce. What's next? Tony Pulis in at Nottingham Forest? Phil Brown coming in to take over from David Moyes at Everton? What's going on? Why are football clubs mad? So I thought that might be the basis of an interesting conversation. So that's exactly what we're going to do. We're going to talk some Arsenal stuff as well. With me to have that conversation, delighted to welcome back to the show from CBS Sports, it's James Benge. Hello, James.
Hi, Andrew. How you doing?
I'm pretty good. Thank you very much. Feeling better after, obviously, Arsenal got back to winning ways during the week against Chelsea. You know, a few days have passed now. Just your cliff notes on what was, I think, a fairly pressurized game because of what had come before and how convincing, is that the right word? How convincing the defeat was against Manchester City in the previous game, or how emphatic perhaps might be the right way of putting that. There was an element of pressure on Arsenal to respond and to get back to winning ways, albeit against the Chelsea side that we know have been struggling this season. So your thoughts on the Arsenal performance and the way they responded?
Yeah, I mean, to be frank, I don't have many. I guess going into the game, I'll try and explain why.
Yeah.
Going into the game, I think we all sort of thought, like you said, everyone knew Chelsea's form was down, but for a London derby, you expect a team to raise itself. There is talent in that team. And, you know, I mean, everyone rightly chastises Frank Lampard, but I'd seen them have good moments against Real Madrid. And you think Arsenal are in a bad moment, Chelsea will be motivated to cause them some problems. So that's what I thought before the game. After it, I have had absolutely no thoughts about Arsenal whatsoever, beyond some kind of quite basic ones. Kivior was all right. It was very good for them on an emotional level to get a win. But all I thought was, this Chelsea team are truly diabolical. They might be the worst team in the Premier League. When I was speaking to people I know that cover Chelsea and are around Chelsea, they told me that. Like, people will think this is Arsenal Schadenfreude. Speaking to people around Chelsea, they were like, oh, yeah, actually, no, if this is like a 42-game season or something weird, could actually get relegated. The second-best team in the league, and Arsenal are still, I believe, that, comfortably smashed the first or second-worst team in the league. And so, yeah, kind of from an Arsenal perspective, I was like, no, I'm not getting carried away by how Jakub Kivior did against the shadow of Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang. You know, three balls to nowhere from Raheem Sterling. No Arsenal thoughts. I know I've come on an Arsenal podcast, so I'm sorry to have let you down.
No, that's okay. I mean, I have to say, you know, I felt a little bit sorry for Aubameyang. I talked about this on the Arscast Extra with James. You know, the idea of selecting him up front for a game like this, and Lampard basically said, you know, he was doing it for the vibes. It was all about the narrative. Tim Stillman sent me some quotes on Twitter, which basically said, yeah, it's his former club, so he'll be extra motivated, blah, blah, blah. But this is a guy who hasn't played or started a game since November, you know.
What is that? Like, if I wrote a piece like about, you know, how it would be great to pick Aubameyang because he's extra motivated, people would be like, that's bad reasoning, that's bad, that's boring. Yeah. That's a boring view, and it doesn't talk to football.
No, that's it. I mean, you know, and look, there are a lot of football opinions out there, some good, some bad, but you normally expect people who have played the game for a long time or worked in the game, or, you know, this is a, you know, a big football club, they have a man in charge who's just basically picking a team because
it's what a YouTuber would do.
Well, that's kind of it, isn't it?
A bad one as well.
Yeah. I did feel a little sorry for him, you know, because he gave us great moments and, you know, he scored a lot of goals for Arsenal at a time when Arsenal were not always great, it's fair to say. There's that clip doing the rounds, isn't there, just before kickoff, and North London Forever is ringing around the stadium and he's sort of looking around going, oh, I remember this. I used to be here. This was nicer than being at whatever the hell Chelsea is these days. But while we're talking Chelsea, I think, you know, it's an interesting idea to explore, you know, what football clubs are doing and how they're making decisions and the people that they have making decisions. So Chelsea, you know, clearly not my favorite football club, or anybody listening to this, not their favorite football club. The one thing you would say about Chelsea under Roman Abramovich is that they were very well run. They had good people making decisions. Sometimes they were ruthless to the point of it was just brutal at times the way that they made decisions. But pretty much always it kind of worked out for them because they bring somebody else in who would have some success, and then they would, you know, come to the end of that particular tether and fire them and bring in somebody else. And we know it's all tied up with the money. And I think the influence that Chelsea has had on the modern game is worthy of exploration in more time than we have today because of, you know, how it skewed the ownership or the expectations of ownership and all that kind of stuff. And it's no defense of Abramovich to say that Chelsea were well run when he was the owner. But it is remarkable to have undergone such a 180 in a short period of time where they appear now to be possibly the worst run football club in the world.
It's a fair point. And, you know, you do start racking your brain for rivals, and you don't get many. I think the thing you would add about Abramovich is, you know, he didn't particularly worry what supporters thought of him. He didn't particularly worry what the noise was. He didn't worry what was being written in columns. It seems to me very clear from the way that Todd Boehly and Behdad Iqbali are acting that there is a real concern about fans getting angry at them, about columnists saying that they don't really know what they're doing. They're very keen to get their side of the story out there. They're a lot more open in terms of interviews, in terms of, you know, trying to give a sense of what Chelsea want to do.
Mm.
But what Chelsea want to do is too led by what they're hearing. They don't, the vision changes. The 5.5 year contract or however long it was for Graham Potter, if you sincerely believe he's the right manager and you talk about rebuild, you have to believe in the rebuild. I mean, it sort of seems like, you know, Boehly in particular, people kind of don't fully appreciate that with the Dodgers, the MLB franchise he owns, or he part owns, he doesn't have control there. He is a minority shareholder, doesn't really get to play boss, doesn't really get to get involved and to do the ownership things.
Mm.
And so I think a lot of this season kind of has to be seen through the prism of himself and Iqbali. Not, you know, being a bit like a kid in a candy store, being a bit incapable of you know, calling their urges. I mean, a great example of this is the sacking of Potter when I think it was the Sunday morning after whatever his final game was. You know, the clear indications coming out of Chelsea were that the sporting directors thought, no, you know, we've got to stay the course. We'll see it till the end of the season and we believe in this project. But ownership got capricious. Ownership got excited in much the same way that ownership got excited about Mykhailo Mudryk, who, you know, whether he's a talent or not, I thought he had some nice little flashes, the sort you would... Maybe he was the one that had a point to prove against Arsenal and that Frank Lampard should have started. But again, with that, you know, Chelsea had loads of options. They'd just bought Raheem Sterling, whatever you think of Pulisic. They had all these players on the left wing. But they saw that Arsenal were getting this fun, exciting new toy, but weren't getting it across the line. And they went mad. And they blew Arsenal out of the water for a player that they don't need... They don't necessarily have a vision of how they fit into the system that neither Graham Potter nor Lampard were blown away with. And I mean, going back to Aubameyang, I agree with you. I think it is, I feel more sympathy for the guy because when Thomas Tuchel was sacked, the mood music, the briefings coming out of Chelsea were, look, we're not panicking here. We've been thinking of doing this for a while. You know, we've had our doubts about whether this whole relationship is simpatico, all that wank. and yet, three, four days, I think it was prior, they had signed a striker for Thomas Tuchel, who the only argument in favour of signing Aubameyang was, well, Thomas Tuchel likes him. Thomas Tuchel knows how he works. We all kind of worry that he can't do it in the Premier League anymore. There's just no joined up thinking. There's no long term view. It's too excitable. It's how we would all act if we owned a football club.
Well, I mean, this is, I just was looking up the ownership, Todd Boehly, Clear Lake Capital, and there are others in this consortium. And Boehly told the press after the takeover, our vision as owners is clear. We want to make the fans proud. Which goes a long way to explain some of the nonsense that they get up to in the transfer market, where they go like, oh, we will beat Arsenal to this player, or, you know, there's a player that another club are interested in. We'll go after them because, well, if they like that player, then it must be a good player. Whether or not that player fits into your, whatever your vision is or your strategy is. And I think, you know, I want to talk about Leeds now in a minute as well, but I'm just, you know, we've had some issues at Arsenal over the last number of years. There was the end of Wenger and all that kind of stuff, and people were in charge and it didn't work out. And I think one of the things that's so, is it comforting is maybe not the right word, but, you know, as this season is looking like it's going to play out in a way that's ultimately going to be a disappointment because of the context of the season, if not, you know, having achieved the pre-season aim of getting back into the Champions League, and I think that's commendable and all the rest of it. But, you know, we were on top for a long time and we've, you know, dropped some points and we've been overtaken by the machine that is Manchester City, and, you know, there's just no way of recovering from that, probably. You know, I know we've got four games to go and all the rest of it, but chances are. But what gives me a measure of solace or comfort or whatever is that this is a club right now where the strategy feels good. There is joined up thinking at executive level between, you know, technical director, the manager, the ownership, all of those kinds of things. You know, and it's quite interesting, the sort of parallel, if you like, with Chelsea, who were this well-run thing and now are a shambles, and Arsenal, who weren't really as well-run as they are right now. And it doesn't take much, or it doesn't take much time for something to go the other way. Do you know what I mean? And there is, you know, there are countless examples of football clubs that are run in crazy ways, but your best chance of success comes when there is that solidity, those foundations, when they are in place, you know, you have the best chance of success, in inverted commas.
Yeah. I mean, Chelsea have kind of all the intangibles, or not intangibles, all the prerequisites that they need to be a hugely successful club beyond the way in which they manage themselves. They have money, they have a superb academy, although, I mean, frankly, that is struggling a little bit of late, and there are a lot of kind of doubts. When they see, you know, when you're the family of a young footballer and you see another, I mean, every time I check Fabrizio Romano's Twitter feed, I'm seeing some 14-year-old child who's been signed for 10 million. But anyway, they've got the academy, they've got the money, they've got the Premier League, they've got London. It doesn't take much to get out of your own way. I would question whether Chelsea have built a structure that allows themselves to do that. It is the definition of too many cooks, with multiple owners all having a view, and you can't change that. But maybe you don't need two co-sporting directors, a technical director, a director of recruitment and talent. I will have missed someone.
Mm.
I know how Arsenal work. You know, and a fan could draw the Arsenal org chart and tell you,
yeah,
this is how decisions are made. Makes sense. I don't know who at Chelsea, beyond the owners who don't really know much about football, has the final say and what the process is. And if your processes don't work, it's very hard to get good outcomes.
That is true. I'm thinking of Leeds this weekend, and everyone is hoping against hope, you know, that maybe Manchester City will slip up against Sam Allardyce's Leeds United. But this is another great example of how a football club that came up that had a manager who had a system, who the players understood and worked hard for, and all those kinds of things, Marcelo Bielsa. And obviously, they're I think, going to be inconsistencies when you're a club like Leeds. But here we are with like four games to go. They've just sacked the manager they brought in to help them avoid the drop, and they're parachuting in out of retirement, a real Hail Mary in Sam Allardyce to try and keep them up in the Premier League, because this season has been crazy. You go back to January, the January transfer window. They gave Jesse Marsh players, money to buy players, and then sacked him pretty much straight away. I mean, what is it about football that makes these big organizations do such nonsensical, ridiculous things because of vibes, if you like?
I suppose it's nothing more than the sort of panic of relegation, isn't it? Because that's why we've seen Leeds hire two managers, Gracia as well, who have entirely ditched their style, their sensibilities. You know, we all know, anyone that's watched Leeds play a game knows, or did under Marsh, did under Bielsa, knows what this football team is supposed to look like, knows how difficult it can be if they catch you on a good day for them, as you remember when Arsenal beat them 1-0. There's a sort of emotional challenge that they've never really got over of, you know, the Bielsa-Marsh thing. It does feel quite similar to Wenger and Emery on a lower scale, obviously, where so much emotion and frankly, so much of the club's capital was invested in Bielsa. The fans, and I know this is obviously the difference with Arsenal, the fans adored him to the last and wanted him to stay. But no one can love the guy after, even if the guy after tries to do the same stuff. And that wasn't working. I don't necessarily think they should have kept Marsh, but you know, they like you said, they built a squad for Bielsa's or Marsh's football, and then they thought, gosh, we need to fix the defence. But I don't know that you can necessarily fix a defence just by having a defensive manager if the players aren't the right players for that. Yeah, they missed Tyler Adams massively. And this is the thing with Allardyce is not going to kind of go there and find that he has the players for 4-4-2 that he can, you know, rely on set piece goals and keeping it tight at the back in the space of three or four training sessions. I mean, as much as I and everyone listening to this want to believe that Allardyce can pull this out of the bag at a moment's notice, there's no evidence from his sort of track record that he immediately does that, because managers that do this, keep it tight, they don't. It doesn't happen right away. It can't. They would be miracle workers if it could. You know, Leeds feel a bit like Everton. So they've said and I think the trouble is when you dive into this Everton, this Sunderland vortex of every decision we make is framed around survival, you're probably just postponing the inevitable, because, you know, when Allardyce goes, maybe they'll try and get in a manager to get back to that style. But you've built in your head the idea that you can just sack the manager and change the style and it might be the best thing. So it's just panic about relegation.
It is. I mean, what do you make of Sam's comments? He said, I may be 68 and look old, but there's nobody ahead of me in football terms. Not Pep, not Klopp, not Arteta. It's all there with me, and I shared it with them. They do what they do, I do what I do. But in terms of knowledge and depth of knowledge, I'm up there with them. I'm not saying I'm better, but I'm certainly as good as they are. And look, I wrote about this a little in the blog on Thursday, and a couple of people, like, you can't listen to those quotes or read those quotes and not have a kind of slightly humorous reaction to them. Some people said to me on Twitter, he's just taking the pressure off the players. But I don't know if that's necessarily true. It seems like a generous interpretation of those comments, given some of the previous that we've had from Sam Allardyce, of course, you know, when he talked about his tactical knowledge in the past.
Yes, I think there is a man there who, I don't know him. Maybe that's an advantage, because I think to an extent, you know, he has fostered a really good relationship with some parts of the media, and that has doubtless helped him. And that's what sometimes you have to do in your line of work. I think there is a man there with a bit of a chip on his shoulder who perhaps rightly looks back at what he achieved at Bolton. And I know Arsenal fans hate being reminded of this, but a team that punched vastly above its weight, that did, we were talking about this in relation to Leeds, and people were talking about ditching Moneyball principles, and Moneyball's a word that doesn't really mean anything in English football discourse, but if you want to look for someone that exploited market inefficiencies, that was ahead of the curve on data, it's Allardyce at Bolton with his video scouting and his signing of JJ Okocha and Yuri Djorkaeff and some of your favourite players before they played for Bolton, picking all them up. And I think to an extent he feels like history has done him harshly. And he may be right. Like, there is no right way to play football. And if he gets the results, then he is vindicated. But it feels a lot like reputation management from a man that's taking the paycheck, which could be gigantic if he keeps Leeds up. Doesn't necessarily want to wants to distance himself from a relegation that, to me, looks quite likely.
Pretty much inevitable. And, you know, the thing about it is that, you know, he did get to manage Newcastle. You know, what are they called? A sleeping giant. I'm not sure that's necessarily... Yeah, he put them to sleep permanently. The final trip to the vets. Well, maybe that should have happened in Newcastle before all the other stuff happened. You know, but he did get to manage Everton, you know, a big club, you know, with some pedigree. He got to manage West Ham, a big club in London. So he did have his moments. He did have his chances. Of course, the England job as well, which ended for non-footballing reasons. But
it's the way we'd all want to go out. Pint of wine in hand.
A big fat goblet of wine. Yes, true. Let's talk a little about Arsenal now. What's one thing you would like to see from Mikel Arteta next season? Clearly, there's still a bit to do this season, but, you know, with time to reflect over the summer, and I think we all understand that the club are going to do some business and all the rest of it. But as he continues his development as a manager, what's one thing you would like to see?
That's a good question. I think that, especially talking about, you know, referring to the business this summer and what we expect to happen, 4 or 5 strong recruits, and with Champions League football, I think this is a time where Arteta needs to push away from an 11, a 12, a 13 or 14, which is probably where Arsenal have been at this season, certainly was that where they were last, and really exploit some of the talent and don't not have a set 11 that people can game plan against. I think it's been pretty clear for a while, even before Saliba got injured, that teams had maybe worked out a better way to create shots from Arsenal, going long, beating their press. You know, more players means greater variety in terms of how you play, in terms of the players you use and the freshness of them I think it's really important that Arteta doesn't get to a stage where next season's Emile Smith Rowe, a player of great talent, it just can't play because he hasn't played before for weeks on end, months on end. And I know there are injuries to factor in with a lot of these players, but players that are just atrophying on the bench that can't fully be trusted. I mean, what are Arsenal at now? 15 players, you would say. You know, the 11 that played against Chelsea with Partey and Martinelli and a couple of others. That needs to become a squad of about 20. That's how many Pep uses. Mm. And they are all of high-grade talent. But actually, I kind of think if what Arsenal want to happen happens in the summer, then they could well have about 20 really good players to use. And I want to see Arteta using kind of all of them from August onwards, so that even right the way through to May, like no one knows how Pep Guardiola is going to play against Leeds other than a couple of pieces. I think everyone knows at full strength what Arsenal would do. And if Arsenal can develop some unpredictability, some change-ups in their substitutions, that's another thing he could work on. That's next step. That's getting closer to City there.
There was an interesting question after the... I think it was after the Chelsea game. Maybe it was before the Chelsea game, but in the embargoed section of the press conference, where he was asked about the physicality of Manchester City versus the physicality of Arsenal. And look, I don't think Arsenal are a small team. I think we've got some big guys. You know, when you think about when everyone's fit, you've got a spine of the team that includes Saliba and Gabriel, Ramsdale, Partey, Xhaka. You know, not huge guys. But clearly Manchester City have, you know, like they're technically, they're still amazing. But the teams you associate with Pep Guardiola down the years have been those classic Iniesta, Xavi, Aguero, Silva. I'm not going to say lightweight because that sounds pejorative. I don't mean that. But clearly there is a physical difference between those players and, let's say, Rodri and De Bruyne and Haaland, obviously, who is, you know, I don't know quite how to describe him in a way that sort of does it justice. And you know, when a player like that comes along, I think Andrew Allen actually described it really well, referring to Jonah Lomu as a player who just sort of added something new to the game of rugby. And all of a sudden, people had to deal with that and contend with that. Is that something you think Arsenal could add when they are building this squad? Because, you know, they've got brilliantly technical players and Saka, Martinelli, Odegaard, Jesus now all over 10 Premier League goals for the season, four players on over 10 Premier League goals, Odegaard with 14. You know, the technical level isn't low by any means. I think you can always add to that. But is it trying to maybe find that in combination with something a bit extra that allows you to, let's say in a game against Chelsea where you're 3-0 up at halftime and the conversation is at the break, let's score another one, let's get four goals, let's get five goals, which is what Xhaka was talking about on TV afterwards. You know, is that a way of maybe asserting your dominance in fixtures where you're on top and you don't want the last 25 minutes to be nerve-wracking because you've let in a silly goal and you haven't scored enough?
That's definitely one advantage to physicality. I almost kind of look at it in a different way, and it goes back to that City game. And the reason why I just thought watching that game, I didn't even feel that critical of Arsenal, because it just became quickly apparent with Haaland. I love, in basketball, they call players like him a unicorn. I mean, there's actually quite a few of them now in the NBA, but they're not supposed to exist. You can't be that tall, that strong, that technical.
That quick.
And that was the point, was you could, you know, in the old, you could press City well and force them to go long before this season. And that was your way of getting the ball back. It was 50-50s maybe, but it was your chance. It was really hard. And actually, I thought there was a lot of debate about Arsenal's press. I thought it was better than it got credit for. But part of the challenge is just the gigantic guy at the other end who can dominate you. And I think, obviously, as I say, unicorn, Arsenal can't get Haaland. But what I would like to see Arsenal do is another way of advancing the ball into that final third. I know Clive on the Arsenal Vision talks about this a lot as well. I don't want to claim this is my idea. Is it a Tammy Abraham, a player like that, that can be your route out of the press? Arsenal are so good at beating opposition press, which doesn't really come anymore, through the interplay of Zinchenko, Gabriel, Saliba, Partey. You know, they can pass around it, they can run through it, but eventually they will need to be able to go over it. And I think that means, you know, tough conversations about maybe some of the reserve players. I don't like the idea of changing up how Arsenal's strongest 11 plays massively. Mm-hmm. Couple of bits of honing here and there, but is Eddie Nketiah going to be a player that wins 70% of his aerial duels? Does a conversation need to happen about whether Arsenal do need a presence in the box for when things get desperate, as they always do, and you start flinging crosses in? That, I think, and that from a physicality perspective up top, that's where I would like to see Arsenal just add a little bit more oomph, someone that can back into defenders. Jesus will fight them all day, and I feel like in the pub car park, he'd be pretty scrappy. Yeah. But, you know, an Abraham, a big, tall centre forward that's mobile, I think could really add something.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And I think part of that is because, you know, as you do get better, teams will sit off a bit more. Like, you think about the way Newcastle, you know, who are coming up this weekend, and we'll talk more about the Newcastle game in our Patreon preview pod. So I don't want to go too deep into the weeds on this one. But when you think about the way Newcastle came to play at the Emirates and look at the way they're playing now and look at how they can hurt teams by playing on the front foot, but they came to the Emirates and they sat. And Arsenal found it difficult to break them down and maybe didn't have quite the tools to deal with 6'7" Dan Burn just bopping the ball away like a Birmingham City centre half in the early 2000s, standing on the edge of his box, bang, 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 bang. And I think more teams will play like that against Arsenal, the higher the level goes. And we experienced that down the years with loads of teams who played, came, sat, parked the bus, whatever you want to call it, and just said, okay, break us down. Break us down. And some days you have the craft, and some days you have the precision, and some days you have the guy who will pick the pass, or some days you've got the guy who will spank one in from 30 yards because they're sitting so deep that, you know, that space is there to have a shot. But there are going to be other days where you do need something different. And I don't mean like fucking just bang it up to Tony Cascarino up there and see what he can do. But I think Haaland has kind of redefined that role. You know, he used to have he's got good feet for a big man. He's got good everything for a big man. And that is perhaps the next development in how football teams operate. Like, not everyone is going to be able to get a Haaland, but you might be able to get somebody who's got some of those qualities who can give you some of what he gives Manchester City, who, you know, for all the technical ability, for all the tiki-taka, for all the precision, for all the tactics, for all of it, we're not afraid to just fucking lump it up front over the top of the Arsenal midfield and look at what their big guy did. He played it off to a slightly less big guy who can run, and we were in all kinds of trouble.
It was great. I mean, like, with Oasis playing at halftime as well, I thought it was 1995 all over again. It wasn't great. It was horrible.
Quinn and Dickoff up front for, yeah.
Get it launched. You could hear Graham Taylor in your head going, hit Les.
Yeah. You mentioned some of the reserve players and some of the decisions that Arsenal are going to have to make, but also, interestingly, some of the decisions that the players themselves are going to be making. It's reported that Reece Nelson has rejected a contract offer from Arsenal. He's been playing a bit more regularly this season. People will be saying, well, look at what he could contribute. Look at what he did contribute. But I think players are well aware of which way the wind is blowing as well, particularly inside a club that they've been at their whole lives. With someone like Nelson, you know, there is an offer, I think, that Arsenal could make that makes sense to the club. But from the player's perspective, the chance to go somewhere and play more regularly has got to be part and parcel of their thinking. And we've seen that this week with Charlie Patino talking about how he wants to play regular first team football again. This is something we talked about on the Arscast Extra. You know, if he wants to go play, great. But I don't think if you want to raise the level to a team that can compete for the Premier League and the Champions League, he's quite at that level yet, right? So that makes sense. How do you view these kinds of decisions for the club? You know, particularly someone like Nelson, you know, it makes sense for him maybe to go somewhere else on a Bosman.
Yeah, I think from Nelson's perspective, look, you know, my understanding, yes, he has rejected the contract offer, but he actually hasn't made up his mind yet. He is still really considering all of his options because for the reason you've laid out there, he's well aware of what his role would be at Arsenal. I believe he's an Arsenal fan. Obviously, he's certainly grown up with the club and it would be a real wrench for him to leave on a personal level. But equally, it is really frustrating when he feels like he's taking big strides I would suspect he feels like he's taking big strides and yet there's these immovable objects of Martinelli and Saka ahead of him, younger than him, not going anywhere at all.
Mm.
It's really tough when you know his talent. And yet, you know, I mean, I know, for instance, right before that Bournemouth goal,
mm-hmm.
I think he'd pretty much made up he was really starting to open himself up to the idea that he might go. And when you have moments like that with a club that you spent so long at, I am certain it becomes a lot harder to leave and a bit of a wrench. Equally, look, you know, I mean, I think I kind of wrote this back in March, just after that goal. When Brighton are the team chasing you, Nice, the Milan clubs want you, I think it becomes quite sensible to go. I guess actually from Arsenal's perspective, when I see these really sparky games off the bench and think, you know, a Moussa Diaby, another wing option, another player that's off the right, that's a 40, 50 million pound signing. Does it make sense to overpay on Nelson if you believe that he could be I suppose the question is, do you believe he could start some Champions League games, some easier Premier League games and score a lot of goals and create a lot of goals and win you games? If so, like say to Reece Nelson, what's the money that will change your mind and make you reassess your career development?
Is it about money though? You know, because clearly that would be a factor. It always can be. Like here's, you know, a monstrous amount of money. Oh, look, my principles have gone out the window because of that, you know. But I think when you're his age, when you've been through the difficulties that he's had in terms of injuries where, you know, there were periods he should have gone on loan, picked up an injury in preseason or picked up an injury in January, couldn't make that loan move, and then has found himself stagnating, I guess. And we've seen, you know, he was certainly one of the most highly rated youngsters. You know, that crew that came out at the same time with Maitland-Niles, Reece Nelson, Eddie Nketiah, Joe Willock, that kind of generation. You know, he was really, really highly rated as one of the top prospects, but you know, his career hasn't really gone the direction he would have liked, or maybe Arsenal would have liked. You know, this might be a much easier decision for Arsenal if the injuries hadn't hit him the way that they had. So it's finding that balance, isn't it, between the need to play, the desire to play, but also the money on offer and the opportunities that you might have. You know, Brighton must be very, very tempting at this point because, you know, if Brighton are after you, if you're a player and Brighton are after you, you're thinking, hey, I must be actually pretty fucking good here because, you know, they've got their eye on the ball. But, you know, it looks like a bit like Arsenal as well. I'm not sort of taking away from this. It looks like it's a good place to be, a fun place to be. The manager is good. The squad is good. The football is good. You know, everyone's kind of happy with the way things are going. And, you know, that would be a temptation, I guess.
Yeah, I think so. And as much as I say there, you know, there's money that I'm speculating there that there's money that could convince him to stay. I think if you have a conversation with Brighton, especially a Brighton that has Europe, and they say, look, you know, we do see you as being a regular starter. I mean, by the way, a natural left winger, yeah, you know, you've got Gabriel Martinelli for competition at Arsenal. Small matter of Kairo Mitoma for competition at Brighton. But I think maybe the... it's a chance for... I think maybe his career needs a launch pad. It needs something to take the next step.
Mm.
He could be a really good reserve for Arsenal, but I don't think he would fulfill his, like you laid out there, his enormous potential.
Mm.
I don't know if he would at Brighton either, but it seems a logical step for him. And as much as Arsenal, it would have been nice for them to get a fee for him at some stage in his development. Like, he has already been an incredibly valuable academy graduate. He's got goals. He's got big performances and done that on low wages. It's been a great investment by Arsenal that's paid itself back plenty.
Speaking of, the other player I'm thinking of this summer where I guess folks will be torn considering what he's done out on loan is Flo Balogun. And there were some stories a couple of weeks ago. You know, when you see stories like this in the media, you know they've come from, in inverted commas, the player's camp, right? About how he wants to play regular first-team football, but he knows Gabriel Jesus is there. And we've already talked maybe about Arsenal doing something a little different up front, having a different profile of player. And, you know, I'm not saying that Balogun is exactly the same as Jesus or exactly the same as Nketiah, but they're in the same ballpark, I think. Physically and how they play the game. And he's done extremely well on loan in France and scored a lot of goals. That feels like, you know, as much as Arsenal might say, you know, we need depth and we do need depth and they might need more than two strikers next season. If you've got Champions League, that third striking option might get plenty of game time. It's one of those where it's stacking up to be the sort of decision that you make, strike while the iron is hot, in a way, to maximize the revenue that you bring in on an academy player who could help fund some purchases elsewhere, which in the short to medium term might be better suited to the squad building project that the club are undertaking.
100%. I mean, even compared to Nelson, this one actually feels to me quite easy and quite obvious. You know, warm congratulations to Balogun as he leaves the door, but £35-40 million, if you can kind of get that. I think a lot of the interest will come from the European market, but he has done so well in France that it seems like that interest is there. The likes of Leipzig, a lot of clubs in the market, and a lot of clubs that will lose their striker to a big Premier League team who will think, Balogun's young, Balogun's talented, and we now have seen that track record. And yeah, I would say that is a huge success from Arsenal's perspective. What they've done, they've turned a situation that I remember, was it 2 years ago, whenever he signed his contract, looked really hairy, like they could lose both Nketiah and Balogun for nothing.
Yeah,
and they've turned that into a first team centre forward, and hopefully, from their perspective, £30-40 million in the bank. So it's a well-managed situation, shows what getting the right loans can do, and something we maybe don't talk about enough. That's happening more and more with Arsenal. And so credit to Ben Napper and Edu for that, because what a great bit of business this has been.
Yeah, well, it could well turn out to be. And just final thing, you know, going into this summer, and we've talked about recruitment and talked about how to build the squad. Selling is going to be something I think a lot of people have their eye on. And with Balogun, Nelson's going to go for free. But there are other players who've been out on loan this season who the club need to move on, probably. You know, Nuno Tavares started very well at Marseille. I don't know what mayhem is happening there around him now. They're always
him and Matteo Guendouzi in one team. Not quiet.
I saw stories during the week about Guendouzi leaving Marseille. Basically said Guendouzi's going to leave. That's what's going to happen this summer. So expect him to rock up at Aston Villa.
Yes,
no two ways about that, right? But you know, players like Lokonga, who's not really playing at Crystal Palace. We sent him to work under Patrick Vieira, and you know, it didn't end well for either of them there. But these guys, you know, who realistically don't have any future at Arsenal, is there a way that the club can use the newfound stature as a, you know, as one of the top teams in England to help facilitate moves when previously it's been a little more difficult because the perception of you as a football club isn't quite as high as it is right now, if that makes sense?
Yeah. I think the difference between now and a few years ago, I mean, the most crucial one is these players we're talking about, Tavares, Lokonga, they're young and they're not on 150,000 a week. I mean, we should emphasize they're still on a lot of money by the perspective of teams in Ligue 1 and in the Bundesliga, let alone, you know, the rest of the leagues outside Europe's top five. It's not going to be easy, but we saw this with Liverpool, and I think they had a fantastic team and a fantastic director of football in Michael Edwards. But when you are a successful team, even your fringe players, even your loanees, people think Arsenal are a competent football club. We know they've bought good talent across the team. I don't think many people would say that players like Nuno Tavares and Lokonga aren't talented, and they're not old. You know, clubs will say to themselves, there's resale value in Lokonga. If it doesn't work out right, it might work out well. And there's lots of resale value in Lokonga. I don't think it's easy because every Arsenal player is on a wage that shrinks the pool gigantically. But compared to when they were trying to clear out the Socratises, who I know we both like, the Mustafis, who I know we don't, and the Kolasinacs of the world, at least these guys are 6-7 years younger and on a little bit more of an affordable wage. And also, like, a few Balogun's and Tierney's here and there mean you can take a bit of a knockdown rate, and you can say, oh, you know, give us some long-term clauses to make the deal work on Lokonga, on Tavares, because you've got the good players who you can sell for really good money.
Yeah.
It looks all right.
It's going to be fascinating to see. Like, I'm not so invested in balancing the books, but I really would like to see Arsenal sell well and then obviously reinvest. So I think that's just another step forward in the evolution of the team and the squad and the club in this current project. We bought well, now start selling well and buy better, I guess is the way to do it. Right, we better leave it there. As ever, James, a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Thank you very much indeed to James. You can find him on Twitter. He is at James Benge, at James Benge. So we have a big game, of course, this weekend, taking on Newcastle away from home at St. James's Park, where last season, well, it didn't go well. It did not go well. But last season, things did not go well at White Hart Lane. And this season, they fucking did. So let's hope we can do a bit of that on Sunday. It's going to be tough. We don't have any team news as of this moment, recording on Thursday evening. But for those of you on Patreon, we will have a preview podcast, as we do for every Premier League game. Myself and Lewis Ambrose will look ahead to the trip to Newcastle on Sunday afternoon. So you can join us at patreon.com/arseblog. James and I will have an arsecast extra for you on Monday morning. In the meantime, I don't know. I can't even say it out loud. We all know what we would like to happen this weekend, as far-fetched as it is. So maybe by not saying it out loud, that's a load of bollocks. Leeds are going to get absolutely spanked, aren't they? Yep, that's pretty much what's going to happen. Anyway, don't let that bit spoil your weekend. Let's hope Arsenal can do the business on Sunday. For now, take it easy, enjoy your weekend, and we will catch you on the next one. Until then, cheers. Bye-bye. Welcome back to Holy God FM. It's been an exciting week here at the radio station. We've got a brand new special effects machine that makes you sound like you're in a cathedral. Hello! But now, something a bit more serious. We have a letter here from Richard. And Richard says, "Dear Holy God FM, I'm feeling very sad for my good friends who can't find any work these days. They are very competent men, good at their jobs, but all the companies now want to bring in foreign workers. These men are dyed-in-the-wool legends of the areas that they grew up in. Shouldn't we look after our own? Keep the local economy booming, as they say. But no. And my friends now just have to sit around, unemployed, while people from all over the world come to our country and take all the jobs. Maybe you could offer some advice." And that comes from Richard, who now lives and works in Qatar. Well, Richard, I've thought long and hard about this, and I do have some advice for you. It's quite simple. People in glass houses shouldn't throw stones. Now let's get on with the music here at Holy God FM, and apropos of nothing, here's a classic from Warren Zevon. It's The Werewolves of London. Ow!
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.